You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Follow us on social media at CJSF on Twitter, on Facebook and Instagram at CJSF Radio. Listen to old episodes and special programming on our SoundCloud at CJSF 90.1. Diverse, independent, and yours.
At the time of the coup, McNamara was opposed to it. John McCone, the head of CIA, was opposed. The Joint Chiefs across the board were opposed to the coup. If you wanted to stay in Vietnam, let alone win in Vietnam, you certainly would have backed Diem. If you wanted to stay in Vietnam, then the important thing to do was not to kill Kennedy. It was to head off the coup against Diem.
That's Daniel Ellsberg, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. Welcome to this special program honoring Daniel Ellsberg on the origins of the Vietnam War. In this program, Daniel Ellsberg discusses early U.S. support for France's effort to retain control of its Indochina colony. In a little-known and scary fact of history, Ellsberg describes Eisenhower's offer of nuclear weapons to the French to stave off defeat at Dien Bien Phu in 1954. Within a few years, the U.S. supplanted the French and expanded the war to all of Indochina. Ellsberg looks at Washington's policy of backing corrupt regimes in Saigon, first by Kennedy and then by Johnson. You've probably heard the figure of 58,000 Americans killed in the war. There's scant mention of the millions of Vietnamese, Cambodians, and Laotians who were victims of U.S. military intervention. Daniel Ellsberg lived a long and remarkable life. His release of the Pentagon Papers in 1971 was a momentous event. It blew the lid off of Washington's mountain of lies and deceptions about Vietnam. It ultimately led to Watergate and Nixon's resignation. Kissinger called Daniel Ellsberg the most dangerous man in America. Daniel Ellsberg went from being an establishment figure with hawkish military views to one of the greatest whistleblowers in history. He received the Right Livelihood Award and the Olof Palme Prize for his profound humanism and exceptional moral courage. He was a decades-long peace advocate and an outspoken supporter of other whistleblowers such as Edward Snowden, Chelsea Manning, and Julian Assange. Daniel Ellsberg passed away on June 16th at the age of 92. I had a chance to talk with Daniel Ellsberg when he was in Boulder, Colorado in 1998.
The mid-April death of Pol Pot has once again thrust Cambodia and Indochina and U.S. involvement in that peninsula and into people's consciousness. There was a whole series of specials on Cambodia and Pol Pot and a rather remarkable comment by Peter Jennings, which was, in terms of mainstream media, was startling. He suggested that there was a possibility that the massive U.S. bombing of Cambodia was somehow connected to the rise of Pol Pot.
The connection has been made for a long time. After all, Shawcross's book, Sideshow, by William Shawcross, made the point, of course, long ago, that it had been the U.S. policy that of bombing Cambodia, first almost surely conniving and certainly encouraging and supporting the overthrow of Sihanouk by Lon Nol, which had been long hoped for and long planned in some way through the U.S. And then the massive U.S. bombing of Cambodia had been the essential, created the seedbed for the rise of the Khmer Rouge, that particular faction of resistance forces. After all, the U.S. bombing resulted in refugee flows within Cambodia of something like 2 million people. out of a population between 6 and 7 million. So a third of the people of Cambodia under our bombing shifted their homes. The society, in a very short space of time, there were comparable refugee flows in terms of size and scale in Indochina, but over a much longer period of time. And that may have been an absolutely unprecedented disorganization of any society, and of a rural society like that, where the people were extremely attached to their homes and their grave sites. It was, in effect, a reshuffling of society, as you would shuffle a pack of cards, practically, in an extremely anomic situation. And it was in those circumstances that the unusually esoteric doctrines, hardly known even to the rank and file of the Khmer Rouge, were able to, and the leadership of that, was able to take power. It was a sideshow, in effect, both for the North Vietnamese, for the Vietnamese, and for the U.S., a situation in which the Chinese, as I understand it, were basically backing Khmer Rouge against the DRV forces. And it wasn't at all necessary or foretold that the liberation of Indochina, and specifically of Cambodia from foreign domination, should lead to the domination of the Khmer Rouge. Of course, in particular, of course, under Sihanouk, Cambodia had achieved a position that was neutralist in more than name. He really had kept his country largely out of the conflagration. And to overthrow him was an evil act, which was intended, planned, worked for by the U.S. I say that to this day, smoking guns, in the sense of conclusive evidence that we conspired to overthrow him while he was out of the country, is still lacking, although there's a great deal of circumstantial evidence that convinces me that we were, in fact, the U.S. was, in fact, behind that. But there's no question at all that we had hoped for it and encouraged Lon Nol, and he was led to believe from the beginning that he would have our support in doing this. Well, that was, of course, a disastrous development for Cambodia and started the train of events from then on, accompanied, as I say, by our bombing. So in that sense, then, we bear great responsibility for the deliverance of that society to the brutal and, and fanatically ideological Khmer Rouge. We share responsibility. To give us all the responsibility would be wrong. That would be to imply that Pol Pot and his lieutenants had no role, had no responsibility, or the Cambodians, or for that matter, people like Sihanouk, who from then on faced a series of dilemmas and devil's bargains and shifted from one side to the other, and because of the enmity and fear of the Vietnamese in particular among the Cambodians. So there's responsibility that's widely shared, but we bear a very heavy share of it. Even though we didn't intend for Pol Pot, of course, the takeover, I would say the next phase began when we became the effective allies of Pol Pot, and absolutely one of history's greater, more savage ironies, I would say, more macabre jokes, which remains unknown to almost all Americans. Pol Pot rightly remains a symbol of cruelty in the service of ideology and power. And yet, I would suppose very, very few Americans have any sense that in our detente and general alignment with the Chinese and our general bitterness toward our defeat at the hands of the Vietnamese, that we effectively aligned ourselves with the forces supporting Pol Pot, just as the Chinese did. So that, and that's how we came to do it to a large extent. And that's been pretty steadily true right up to the end. There have been we've had a few twists and turns in our own policy, but the burden of it has pretty much put us on the side of Pol Pot, which is, now, granted, it is not unusual for us to be on the side of genocide, as in Indonesia and in various other places. Still, Pol Pot is one of the more blatant, you know, symbols of this. And for the U.S. To be not only tolerant but supportive of Pol Pot goes beyond even what some of the very most cynical observers of American policy might have predicted. But it's the fact. It's the reality. So I did think that from the moment Pol Pot was in custody, that his chances of surviving into a courtroom were very low. There were just too many people, too many different nations and factions who had intense interest in not seeing him called on to testify about their relations with him. And that would include the Chinese, but it would certainly include us. The U.S. would have no interest whatever in whatever we said. We said we were willing to take him into custody. Frankly, I don't think Pol Pot would have been too well advised to be in U.S. Hands, actually. I think his health would not have improved. But we weren't the only ones who felt that we didn't want that past disinterred.
Talk about, in retrospect now, how history has dealt with the U.S. wars in Indochina. One often hears the terms well-intentioned effort, though in retrospect a mistake, noble purpose, those kinds of things.
Of course, there's been a major conscious effort by the establishment, as Noam Chomsky predicted as early as 73. When one could begin to see an end in sight eventually, though the war had not yet ended, that there would be a major effort to capture the history and the interpretation of the war. I think it is true that people who say of the stature of a Carter or a Reagan or almost anybody that the war was a noble cause, which unfortunately went awry and where we didn't pursue it efficiently or wisely, and that it eventually became too costly. I'm talking now about interpretations that do feel the war was right to end, that we should have ended it in the end, but still feel that it had been rightly started. And then, of course, there are others who say it was not only rightly started, but could have been effectively won. That's another strong theme now, increasingly, but let's put that aside for the moment and take even the people who say, well, no, it was inevitable that we had to get out, but that we had been right to get in. That probably is the dominant feeling if you were to take polls, and certainly among the establishment.
You know, the Rambo thesis, the U.S. was fought.
The Rambo is the second school I was talking about, which is especially certain military and right-wing Republicans, right-wing in general, and people like Reagan, who probably were just asleep during the whole war and have, you know, been given brief one-page summaries of what was going on from time to time. But there are military, actually, who still say we could have won, should have won, and so forth. I think they're terribly wrong. They're completely wrong. And that's again, understandably widely shared, because it was hard to... It's hard to imagine that the U.S. could be defeated by such a ragtag group of, you know, fourth-rate power, as Henry Kissinger called them. It's inevitable that one looks for some kind of conspiracy or weakening of will or something that kept us from winning. It's very hard for any power that thinks of itself as a regional great power, even let alone a world great power, to imagine that its allies can't be beaten. That was true of Russia in Afghanistan at first, certainly, and Russia in Chechnya, in their own place. The Israelis did not foresee what they were getting into in Lebanon. The Vietnamese themselves, having beaten us, managed to go into Cambodia with higher hopes of a success than they achieved. The Chinese, of course, went into Vietnam and got a bloody nose, essentially. So it's just simply very hard to imagine that, especially countries that are at a lower technological level, you can possibly muster the will and the motivation to fight you to a stalemate and to tire you out, which is the way these things generally do work. But they just can't conceive how it's possible. They don't understand the empirical principle that a nationalistic resistance force with sufficient motivation and good terrain and open borders and certain other advantages can stalemate even the mightiest powers in the world, the most technologically advanced powers in the world. It's an implausible, counterintuitive fact, but it is a fact that people have to learn over and over again. But let's go back to the notion, though, that was very wide. The other widespread notion is that we were right to go in. Basically, that simply part of that reflects the consciousness of a lot of the officials who told them rather sincerely what they themselves believed about the nature of the conflict. But those officials, in turn, were almost entirely ignorant of the history and very unself-aware of our relation over there. And how this delusion was maintained at the time and over the years is an interesting question. Maybe we'll have time for that. But let me go back to my understanding that would be the basis for my answer to that. I think it's essential to realize there were not two wars, French War and then later an American War. There was essentially one war for 30 years. And it was an American war from the beginning, in which at the beginning the French were effectively our instruments, just as later the Saigon regime and the Vietnamese that we hired were our instruments for the fighting until we took over the bulk of the fighting with our own troops. However, in the very beginning, going back to 45 and 46, we were consciously supporting a French effort to retake by force, to conquer, you know, by violence, a former colony which had declared its independence in March of 1945 and reaffirmed it in August of 45. And it was an independence that was recognized, at least for the northern part of the country, by the French themselves in 45 and 46. Ho Chi Minh went to France as a head of with the honors of a head of state. And the negotiations he was conducting, which came to nothing, were really about the arrangements for unifying the country and for possible elections, at least from Ho's point of view, making arrangements that would settle the governance of the southern part of the country or the central part of the country. But he was being recognized as head of an independent state, at least in the north. That wasn't the French intention, however, in their negotiations. And so when they started to fight their way back from Haiphong to Hanoi in November 1946, it was a military effort to acquire a colony which had been theirs before and which now felt itself to be independent and wanted to be independent and unified. That was an effort without any legitimacy whatever in the second half of the 20th century after the Second World War, from the point of view really of any country in the world, and above all one would have said from the United States with the Atlantic Charter and with our whole anti-imperial declaratory position and our ideology of self-determination and Wilson's 14 points and everything else in our history. It reflected a conscious shift by Roosevelt as early as late 44 and early 45 before he died, that against his own better instincts and desires, which he expressed to his son Elliot and others, that the French had no right to be in Indochina, that they had abused their power there and that they had misused their colonial powers for 100 years, and that the country should be independent, perhaps first under some sort of UN trusteeship. He had changed that policy before he died for geopolitical reasons, in order to preserve an alliance with the French after the war, and also with the British. He had decided not to take an active policy of opposing their continued rule, or in the French case, returned to rule, over their colonies, the British in India, Malaysia, and elsewhere, and the French in Indochina. The French could never have returned their troops to Indochina without our logistic support and our financial support. We provided ships for them. We provided money for that operation. Not so much because we really wanted the French to run Indochina, but because we wanted to support the French who wanted to do that. And later, of course, we had other geopolitical reasons. We wanted the French tolerate the rearming of Germany, basically, and the division of Germany and a rearming of Germany, which wasn't easy to achieve politically, actually. And in connection with that, we supported their colonial ambitions, which were supported, after all, even by the Communist Party of France, which wanted to prove its nationalism in French terms. So what we had was French nationalism versus Vietnamese nationalism about the rule of Indochina, which is so called, after all, by the French, because they, French patriots, thought of themselves as owning Indochina, the way, after all, Americans think of owning Panama, practically speaking. And the Chinese think of owning Tibet. These are sincere beliefs on the part of many of these patriots, but they aren't endorsed by practically anybody else in the world who looks at the situation. So, in short, our support of the French in that case, which came to be more than support, it came to be basically a demand, virtually, that the French take this on, maintain that effort. By 1949 and certainly by 50, the French wanted out. But by that time, with the Chinese in power in Beijing, the Democrats did not want to be accused of losing, quote, of seeing communist control in some new part of the world where we had previously been in control through our allies, the French. And they didn't want that charge. And the French were ready to lift that particular burden from their budget and their troops. But we didn't want them to, so we ended up paying, as you know, I'm sure, more than 80% of the cost of the war, and essentially they were fighting for us by that time. So we start out then supporting a French effort, a totally illegitimate, illegal a fight against self-determination. Within a few years, it's been converted to our fight against self-determination, using the French as instruments as long as they would stay, which wasn't beyond Tien Ben Phu. So it was our war, in short, and a totally wrongful war. No possible way. But that's in terms of the question of our right to win. In short, we had no right to win. And for very related reasons, we had no prospects of winning. After 54, when we took over, we pushed the French out, essentially, and took over the, quote, responsibility, we had no more prospect of defeating the communists by that time than the French had had, which was zero. And we had no more right either. And as I say, the two are related, because the fight against self-determination was one that did not give us loyalty from those of a sufficient nature, motivation to fight for us, of those Vietnamese who were willing to wear our uniforms and our boots and take our pay. They were willing to do that, and they were willing to do various things for it, but they were not willing to fight very effectively.
Well, Eisenhower comes in 53, and his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, reportedly offers the French the use of nuclear weapons. Do you have any information on that?
Yes, I'd heard that story from quite early on, and it is in the Pentagon Papers. Bideau was in a movie, you may recall, that I was interviewed for, Hearts and Minds. They actually interviewed Bideau, and he confirmed or repeated a story that first appeared, I think, in a book by Roscoe Drummond called Duel at the Brink, about John Foster Dulles' diplomacy, which I think was the first time that it revealed. Roscoe Drummond and Gaston Coblentz wrote this book, which I'd read, which revealed that Bideau had told people that he had been offered several nuclear weapons, in fact, three, I think the figure was huge, by Dulles, definitely offered them. The idea being that two would be for the vicinity of Dien Bien Phu, and one would be against China, inside the Chinese border. The idea of it, to send a strong message to China, which was supporting the Viet Minh in its encirclement of Dien Bien Phu. In the documentary, actually, Hearts and Minds, Peter Davis asked Bideau, or some interviewer asked Bideau, about that incident, and he said, yes, Dulles had offered these weapons, and he said, he held up three fingers, he says, I recall, he said, trois weapons, and confirmed that the French attitude had been, as Drummond had written, that the weapons near Dien Bien Phu would be too close to their own troops. We were ready to make that experiment, but the French weren't. And it was French troops in that case, not U.S. And the idea of a weapon against China raised incalculable consequences. It's a little too dangerous. And France itself, after all, was subject to some degree of deterrence there. China did not have nuclear weapons at that time, but was allied with Russia, which did. So, and Dulles, I'm sure, was quite sure that Russia wouldn't respond against France with because we'd use the nuclear weapon against its ally China, and probably he was right. Almost surely he was right. But France didn't want to make that particular experiment. And so they turned down the weapons.
Well, let me ask you, is it conceivable that Dulles made this offer without Eisenhower's knowledge and approval?
I would say not, no. That was surely Eisenhower. The notion, by the way, that Dulles acted independently is a very shaky one on the whole. It's mostly wrong. I found that out when I was doing a study of nuclear crises, which, by the way, I did in 1964 with very high access to documents. I didn't, as it happens, include 1954 Indochina. I didn't even think to look at that. It would have been interesting. I looked at the Cuban Missile Crisis, but in particular, I looked at Suez. I had a particular interest in that because I had extended in the Marine Corps in 56. And because of the Suez Crisis, the Alsop brothers in the spring of 54, when I was due to get out of the Marine Corps and go to Harvard as a junior fellow, wrote a series of columns that there was going to be war in the Middle East because of Nasser's nationalization of the Suez Canal. And they were right, of course, there was war. Well, I didn't want that to happen while I was back at Harvard, and my battalion, which was due to be in the Middle East, with the 6th Fleet, was somehow at war. Been a company commander in the battalion, and I had been the assistant training officer for the battalion. So I turned down my junior fellowship, actually, and re-extended in the Marines for a year and went over. So in the crisis, the Suez War, did take place while we were over there, and we actually evacuated all the Americans from Suez. And I actually watched British-French bombing raids of Cairo on the ship's radar when we were in the harbor of Alexandria. And there's very other stories I could tell about that. In fact, I could say I was in the harbor when the British and French were bombing Alexandria Harbor. Flak fell on our ship and so forth. So I had a particular interest in that war. And among other things, by the way, I saw at the time local in the Mediterranean, a lot of pictures, more than I think appeared in the U.S., of the destruction of Port Said by British and French bombers, which was very thorough, enormous bombing, and remembering feeling very ashamed of our wartime allies for doing this, and thinking to myself, I'm glad I'm not a British or French person who has to look at pictures like this. That was in 1956, and I was actually proud of what I understood to be Eisenhower's position of opposing aggression, even by our allies. That's what I was in the Marines to do, was to oppose aggression, I thought, you know. And here we were doing it, even when it was against our NATO allies, and they were indeed very angry at us and so forth. It's an interesting story there, actually. Mm-hmm. That was the feeling that I had, that this was very good. In fact, I was a training officer for the battalion on this flotilla of ships, and I conducted a number of lectures. I studied the history of the area on the ship's Encyclopedia Britannica, and then I found some other books, like Arthur Kessler's. Arthur Kessler had a book about the Middle East and some other things, and I concluded, well, Nasser had every right to nationalize this canal. It's a very good thing, and the British and French had no right to do what we were predicting they would do, which was attack. So I was saying, presumably, we'll be fighting them, because you know, they're aggressive. This is aggression. And my fellow officers, who were largely Catholic and understood me to be Jewish, which I am by background, although I was raised as a Christian Scientist, were kind of bemused by the fact that I seemed to be so willing to contemplate fighting Israel, which I was. I was a Marine. We'd fight whoever we were ordered to. If we fought the Egyptians, we would presume we'd do quite well. So I made a landing plan for Alexandria in case we had to make an opposed landing to get our civilians out, if they wouldn't let them out.
You're listening to Daniel Ellsberg on the origins of the Vietnam War.